This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 22nd, 2013. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, federal authorities released charges against the suspect in the Boston bombings as civil rights groups raise concern about how the case is being handled. As the State Department closes public comments on the Keystone XL pipeline, opponents continue a campaign of civil disobedience. And we'll speak to a leading glaciologist about the rapid melting of an ice sheet in the Andes, what it means for climate change, and how it's affecting the local communities.
For them, climate change is in the here and now. They have to deal with it on a daily basis.
Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Rescue efforts are ongoing in China today after a 7.0 earthquake Saturday in Sichuan province. Survivors in outlying areas are still awaiting emergency shelter and rations, and anger is rising as help is slow to arrive. The death toll is up to almost 200. Many rural roads remain blocked after nearly 2,000 aftershocks triggered landslides. Local officials say that about 17,000 families lost their homes, and many others are also sleeping outside, afraid that ongoing tremors may cause damaged structures to collapse. In Syria, opposition activists say they discovered hundreds of dead bodies after fierce fighting in recent days near Damascus. Reports of the death toll range from at least 250 to more than 500. A statement from the local coordination committees of Syria claims forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad killed 450 people in and around Damascus during the past 6 days. The group claims hundreds were civilians, massacred and burned after opposition fighters retreated. Syrian state media reports that government forces inflicted heavy losses among terrorists. At a meeting of the Syrian opposition leadership in Istanbul yesterday, the Syrian National Coalition named a new leader after Ahmed Moaz al-Khatib stepped down. Longtime dissident and prominent member of the Syrian Democratic People's Party, George Sabra, will now serve as caretaker. Following the meeting, Secretary of State John Kerry announced that the U.S. will double its support of non-lethal aid to $250 million. While Earth Day celebrations were held around the world over the weekend, experts gathered in Northern California to examine the growing marijuana industry and the increased use of chemicals by growers. Many are pushing for increased research into the environmental and health consequences of using a product cultivated without regulation. FSRN's Eric Black reports.
In 2012, University of California Davis scientists did chemical tests on dead fishers, marmot-like animals whose habitat includes land often used for marijuana cultivation. Researchers found anticoagulant rodenticides in 79% of the animals. Their report blamed the exposure on contaminated soil and irrigation lines resulting from illegal pot grows on California public lands. But Pure Analytics chief scientist Samantha Miller sees another potential problem.
In the cannabis laboratory world, they're not testing to see whether rodenticides and things like that, mammalian poisons, are being pulled up into the plants. So I think that's another interesting area that actually as an industry we need to start to look at with the widespread use of these things.
Growers feel compelled to use the dangerous substances, according to Miller, because marijuana prohibition prevents them from buying conventional crop insurance. An April Pew Research poll showed 52% of Americans now support marijuana legalization. Six U.S. representatives introduced a bill last week that would require the federal government to respect state marijuana laws. Eric Black, FSRN, Arcata, California.
Massive protests against police continue in India's capital, New Delhi, following the rape of a 5-year-old girl last week. Bismillah Gilani reports.
The rape victim is just 5 and, according to the parents, had gone out to play when she was abducted. The child's parents sought help from police, who did not file a missing persons report. Her family found her 2 days later, locked up in a neighbor's house. A medical examination confirmed rape and severe injuries to her genitals. The victim's parents say the police later offered them bribe to stay silent after they discovered what happened to the child. Protests over the incident continued across the capital for the 4th day today. The anger is directed at the police. Ranjana Kumari is one of the protesters demanding immediate removal of the Delhi police commissioner.
There is no fear. It's not stopping. Somehow we are seeing the insensitivity of the police. They have just closed their minds, and this is not going to be acceptable at all.
India recently introduced a harsh law to deal with the rising cases of sexual crimes against women. The government has also taken several other measures for women's safety following public outcry over the last year's gang rape of a young woman in Delhi. But the incidents of sexual assaults have dramatically increased since. Nearly 400 such cases have been reported since January this year in Delhi alone. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Nearly 200 people are dead in northeast Nigeria after fighting between the military and Boko Haram militants. Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
On Sunday, more than 185 people were found dead, many of them civilians, killed in fighting between the military and Boko Haram. The fighting began on Friday in Baga, a fishing community in the northeast Nigerian state of Borno. Soldiers surrounded a mosque where the suspected members of the radical Islamic extremist sect Boko Haram were housed. Military authorities say the extremists fired heavy machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades and used civilians as human shields. During the hours-long assault that followed, fires destroyed whole swaths of the town. The latest incident comes as the Nigerian government considers offering an amnesty deal to extremist fighters. Boko Haram, which means Western education is sinful, wants its imprisoned members freed and a strict application of Sharia law in Nigeria. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Mountain View, California. Federal officials charged Boston Marathon bombing suspect Johar Tsarnaev today with conspiring to use a weapon of mass destruction against persons and property in the U.S., resulting in death. The FBI reports that Tsarnaev remains in serious condition in the intensive care unit at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center after the nearly 20-hour manhunt that led to his capture in Watertown Friday night. Though several lawmakers are calling for the suspect to be held and interrogated as an enemy combatant, the White House announced Monday that he will be tried in civilian court. However, he was not read his Miranda rights, which the White House said is justified through the public safety exemption to the law. Civil liberties groups are speaking out against this decision, saying violent attacks are not an excuse to erode constitutional rights. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The FBI presented its criminal complaint to Tsarnaev in his hospital bed, charging him with planting the improvised explosive devices at the finish line of the Boston Marathon that killed three people and injured more than 200 last week. They cite evidence obtained from video cameras showing Tsarnaev dropping a backpack just before the explosions took place, and an interview with the person whose car Tsarnaev and his brother allegedly stole Thursday night. According to that witness, one of the brothers forced him out of the car at gunpoint and said, quote, "Did you hear about the Boston explosion? I did that." After Tamerlan was killed and Jokar was captured by police, President Obama vowed to use all the powers of the federal government to solve the many unanswered questions surrounding the bombing.
Why did young men who grew up and studied here as part of our communities and our country resort to such violence? How did they plan and carry out these attacks, and did they receive any help? The families of those killed so senselessly deserve answers.
Under the U.S. Bill of Rights, every criminal suspect is entitled to a lawyer and the right to remain silent, as anything he or she says can be used in court. Law enforcement must remind captured suspects of these so-called Miranda rights before questioning. The only exception to this law is when there's an imminent, ongoing threat to public safety. White House spokesperson Jay Carney told reporters that the Justice Department is invoking this public safety exception with 19-year-old Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who is still unable to speak to federal officials because of extensive wounds to his head and neck.
It is a fact that the public safety exception to Miranda allows for law enforcement to quickly interrogate a suspected terrorist without giving Miranda warnings under certain circumstances to gain critical intelligence and national security information.
Whether officials remind Tsarnaev that he has the right to remain silent and demand a lawyer, he still has those rights. But Bahar Azmi with the Center for Constitutional Rights says the Miranda warning process is still vitally important because most people are not aware of those rights. He told FSRN the Obama administration is abusing the public safety exemption for this case.
The exception really is supposed to be limited to where there is a genuine and immediate threat to public safety, and to the extent that that threat has passed based on the, you know, what the authorities have themselves said, and in any event could not last, you know, two full days, that exception can't apply. But I think what's important to remember is the Obama administration has sort of unilaterally said any terrorism case permits non-Mirandized questioning for a period of time.
Azmi is referring to a 2010 internal FBI memo that expanded the Supreme Court's definition of the public safety exemption, saying that when it comes to suspected terrorists, quote, unwarned investigation is necessary to collect valuable and timely intelligence not related to any imminent threat. Azmi says this change was never reviewed by a court and warned that it could lead to further erosions of constitutional rights. He said that the lawmakers and pundits who say certain suspects shouldn't have Miranda warnings should remember why the procedure was created in the first place.
It comes out of a shocking pattern from the 30s, 40s, and 50s of brutal police interrogations, which produced coerced confessions among the most vulnerable defendants.
Several lawmakers, including South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, want to further strip Tsarnaev of his legal rights. In a statement signed by fellow Republicans John McCain, Kelly Ayotte, and Peter King, Graham said Tsarnaev should be treated as an enemy combatant and questioned without a lawyer or notification of his rights. Carney definitively shot down this suggestion on Monday.
He will not be treated as an enemy combatant. We will prosecute this terrorist through our civilian system of justice. Under U.S. law, United States citizens cannot be tried in military commissions.
And before the suspect was formally charged, New York Democrat Charles Schumer and other lawmakers called for Tsarnaev to be given the death penalty if proven guilty, even though Massachusetts banned capital punishment decades ago. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today is Earth Day, and it is also the final day for public comment on the Keystone XL pipeline. Across the country, opponents have been rallying, carrying out civil disobedience, and trying to educate the public on the dangers of the nearly 900-mile-long pipeline. As the pipeline will carry tar sands oil from Canada to the Gulf Coast, many are pointing out the difficulties of cleaning up the spill that happened last month in Mayflower, Arkansas, and another spill nearly 3 years ago in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that's still being cleaned up. On a conference call today, Becky Bond with Credo Action said more than 60,000 people have signed a pledge to engage in peaceful acts of civil disobedience to stop the pipeline.
These are people who have been absolutely inspired by the amazing work done by activists along the pipeline route, organized by the tar sands blockade, who are not only risking arrest, but are really putting their bodies at risk by chaining themselves to machinery and stopping construction on the pipeline as it goes.
Activists carried out civil disobedience in Oklahoma today at a construction site for the southern portion of the Keystone Pipeline. 61-year-old Iowa resident Alec Johnson was locked to construction equipment to help stall work of the pipeline. He called on others to also take a stand against the pipeline.
This is not about me. Just some old fella. This is about the most important moment in human history. We don't start leaving this stuff in the ground. We don't stop this pipeline. This pipeline gets built, it's going to be game over for my children and your children and everybody's children. And that is intolerable. That is unacceptable. So all the parents out there, you know, this is what you need to do to defend your children. It's not going to be easy. It is going to require sacrifices, and it absolutely has to be done. That's why I'm here.
Activists reported that Johnson was extracted from the machine this morning and arrested. Many have also criticized federal officials for only holding one public hearing on this latest environmental report. It took place last week in Grand Island, Nebraska. Some advocates of the pipeline, including representatives of the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce, pipeline workers, and TransCanada itself, testified in support of the project. But many there were opposed. High school student Helen Winston used spoken word to convey her message.
The earth shudders and trembles beneath our feet. The wind sings our names as it dances over the sand hills. The mighty Ogallala peaks above the ground in Hope County to smile up at us. Because you can feel us. We are many peoples. We are a nation. We are tectonic. We are the farmers, the ranchers, the teachers, the taxpayers. We are the future. We will fight to our last for this place. Because look around. What do you see here that's not worth fighting for? And should the president make the wrong decision, a shockwave will run itself around the world. You will call upon us and ask, what in the hell was that? And we will reply in unison, can you feel us now? Thank you.
While many at the hearing were Nebraska residents, Goldman Environmental Prize winner Hilton Kelly traveled from Port Arthur, Texas, to share his experiences fighting for the health and well-being of communities living near Gulf Coast petrochemical companies.
I grew up smelling sulfur, and it impacted my lungs. I've seen people die from smelling this stuff and working in those plants year after year, trying to make a living for their family, but at the same time, jeopardizing their lives. A man or woman shouldn't have to jeopardize their life just to put food on a table. I understand what the men are doing that are working on this pipeline. They're only trying to provide for their families, but they shouldn't have to sacrifice their lives to feed their families. And what we're asking for is just a fair shake at having a better quality of life than what we're having in refinery towns such as Port Arthur, Beaumont, Houston, Chalmette, and all the other southern regions that have to deal with refineries putting this chemical into our air. We are urging you all to take a close look because we all breathe the same air. We all drink the same water. And all the money in the world cannot be given to me for my child to have to breathe these toxic fumes. Please.
Environmental justice activist Hilton Kelly speaking at last week's State Department hearing in Grand Island, Nebraska on the Keystone Pipeline. Today is the last day to submit public comment, which can be done by emailing keystonecomments@state.gov. Environmental groups reported that more than 1 million comments have been sent to the State Department so far and urged the department to extend the comment period. More evidence is showing that the world's changing temperatures are prompting record ice melt, putting at risk large ice sheets. Though much of the current focus has been on glaciers in Greenland and the Arctic, scientists are finding that glaciers high in the mountains, such as in the Himalayas and the Andes, are also receding. A study published this month in Science magazine documents the rapid changes in an ice cap high in the Andes in Peru, where ice that took 1,600 years to form has melted in just the past 25 years, threatening local communities and putting at risk vital water sources for the region. For more, FSRN spoke with Lonnie Thompson, a glaciologist at Ohio State University and lead author of the report in Science magazine. He began by describing why the ice cap, called Quelccaya, is significant.
Quelccaya is the largest tropical ice cap on Earth, and we know that because since we first went there back in the mid-70s, we've drilled around the world. And it certainly has the highest resolution, annual resolution, of climate and the environment going back almost 1,800 years.
And as you say, you've been going there since the 1970s. One of the key findings of this study is the dating of the plants that were exposed by the glacier melt. What did that tell you about how old these plants are and the rate of ice melt?
Well, the the fact that there are plants being exposed as this glacier retreats is very unusual in itself. But these are wetland plants. There are no woody tissue involved, and they're in growth position. And we first found the plants back in 2002, and we've been collecting plants ever since, and we now have over 60 different collections. And what's really remarkable is in the early days when we were collecting on one side of a lake that was forming, those plants all came back with ages of 4,700 years before present. But over the last 25 years, the glacier has retreated, a very large lake formed, and just in 2011, the glacier moved out of the lake on the other side, and there was land exposed, and there we found plants and collected those, and they all date 6,300 years in age. So it tells us that it took back 6,000 years ago, it took 1,600 years for the ice to advance from that far shore to capture the plants on the near shore. And it's only taken 25 years for that ice to retreat back to where it is today. So those plants tell us that this ice cap has not been smaller than today for over 6,300 years. So it really gives us a perspective on the climate change that is occurring there today.
And there are some dramatic photos as part of the study, as part of your research, where you can even see with the naked eye that retreat of the glacier and the land, the part of the mountains that are exposed.
Yes, I mean, having had the opportunity to go there and re-photograph these sites and to document the formation of lakes that didn't exist when I was a graduate student, really makes for very striking visuals of the change that's taken place in that environment.
In addition to some of these global concerns that you're mentioning, the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, or the indications about climate change, in a more local sense, a current issue is that the glaciers are vital water sources for people in the Andean communities. Is there concern for people in urban areas like Lima or La Paz or rural communities?
Yeah, so I think that if I was to look at a country that is most at immediate risk from climate change, it would be Peru, because it contains 70% of the world's tropical glaciers, and many of those serve the rivers that provide water for hydroelectric power, for irrigation, and for municipal water supplies. And so as those glaciers shrink, those water supplies become more undependable, especially in the dry season. And this is what makes that part of the world so sensitive, is that, you know, there's a wet season, but there's a very distinct dry season in June, July, and August, where there's very hardly any precipitation in the mountains, and the discharge in the rivers depends on the melting of those glaciers. So you in the big scheme for the country of Peru, this is an extremely important issue. But even if you go down to the local area around the Quillcaya ice cap, we've seen lakes form over the last 30 years, and we've seen them disappear in a matter of a year. As the ice retreats to higher elevations, it allows new drainage channels to form, and one valley might become flooded from the extra water, whereas the valley that the lake used to drain into dries up, and the alpaca moss dies, and the locals no longer can graze their livestock in that valley.
So even in the immediate vicinity around the glacier, there are local communities living there, adjusting as these lakes are reappearing and vanishing?
Yes, and to me, for them, you know, climate change is in the here and now. They have to deal with it on a daily basis as far as their water resources and ability to irrigate in order to create pasture land for their livestock.
Lonnie Thompson is glaciologist at Ohio State University and lead author of a report on the Quelccaya ice cap in the Andes published in Science Magazine. Dr. Thompson, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thanks very much, Doreen.
In a case that has spanned decades and international borders, a judge in India has ordered the reopening of a probe into a senior politician's connection to killing of six more than 25 years ago in Delhi. The court has also directed the investigating authorities to take testimonies of three witnesses who now live in the United States. But the witnesses say they have no confidence in the investigating agency, the Central Bureau of Investigation. FSRN Salim Rizvi has more.
The case is related to the killing of three people during the 1984 anti-sex riots in Delhi. An earlier investigation by India's Central Bureau of Investigation, or CBI, cleared senior leader of the Congress Party, Jagdish Taitler, stating there was a lack of evidence. In 2010, a magistrate had accepted the CBI's request to close the case against Taitler and did not put him on trial. But now, Delhi Court Judge Anuradha Bharadwaj has ordered investigators to reopen the probe. The judge said the CBI should re-examine several witnesses. One of them is Jasbir Singh, who now lives in San Francisco. He says he's frustrated by the delay in case.
For the last 29 years, it has been a game of hide-and-seek between the court and the CBI, and no case has been registered against Jagdish Taitler yet. The court can reject our testimonies, but who has given the power to the CBI to clear Taitler of charges?
Taitler is accused of inciting a mob leading to the killings at the Sikh House of Worship, Gurdwara Pulbangash. The investigating agency had said in court that Jagdish Taitler was not present near the Gurdwara on November 1, 1984, when the killings took place. Instead, the agency says that he was in the residence of slain Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, known as Teen Murti House. Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her Sikh bodyguards on October 31, 1984, which was followed by widespread anti-Sikh riots. Jasbir Singh had earlier testified to a CBI team in San Francisco in 2008. Singh claims he saw Taitler addressing a large mob near the Gurdwara and complaining to them that they have not killed enough Sikhs yet. Singh says he is ready to go to India to testify again, but says he fears for his life.
I am ready to appear in any court in India and testify about what I saw and heard on that day. I will perform my duty of telling the truth to the court, but I want a guarantee from authorities for the safety of my life, as one witness was earlier killed after he went to India from the U.S., and no postmortem was performed on his body.
The petitioners for reopening the case claim that the CBI has ignored material evidence against Taitler. But the CBI has questioned the authenticity of many witnesses in the case, including Jasbir Singh. The witnesses, three of whom live in the U.S., say they don't trust the CBI. Gurpatwant Panun is their attorney.
No, we have no hope on CBI. They have been acting as the defense team for the Taitler and other Congress leaders who participated in the mass killing of six amounting to genocide. They are playing the game of hide and seek between the CBI and the Indian judicial system. We do not trust and we have no faith on them.
The politician, Jagdish Taitler, has said there was no evidence to prove that he was present at the scene of killings. But the opposition parties in India accused the ruling Congress party of misusing the CBI to absolve Taitler. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, New York.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina.